Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Lost Feast, Culinary Extinction and the Future of Food, by Lenore Newman. Narrated by Tanya Eby. Section 1. The Beginning of Endings. Chapter 1. Silphium. It began with butter. A surreal amount of butter, glistening with tiny pinpricks of fat. It was studded with fragments of fresh herbs and whipped nearly to a foam. There was bread as well, but it was a supporting character. It, too, was excellent. A dark rye loosely stacked in rough slices on the right-hand side of a plate-sized slab of black lava rock. The butter was mounded up on the left side, a lump the size of a Christmas orange, melting gently where it lounged against the warm stone slab. The stone itself was of the same sort found in the walls of the restaurant and rimming the pool of steaming azure water outside the window. This stone played hide-and-seek among the drifting snow from here to Reykjavik. I took a moment to gaze out on the falling flakes and on the tall blonde bathers reveling in the shimmering water. Some perched on the rocks, and others floated in the pool's volcanic embrace. I'd spent the morning there, and after the meal, and perhaps a short period of digestion, I would return. But for now, there was butter. I plucked another slice of bread from the slab and spread it liberally with butter. The fresh herbs, tiny leaves and twigs I couldn't recognize, gave off the smell of a summer mountaintop. My grandmother liked butter, I thought to myself, my mind rambling in the manner of the solitary diner. My grandmother would have approved of this excess. I settled into my chair and took a slow bite, savoring the flavor and texture. I had a long lunch ahead of me, and yet I was probably going to eat the whole lump of glorious butter. Slowly, the stress of the last few days, the snow, the cold, all melted away. I was in Iceland to study the food of hard places. I had copious notes from my fieldwork in Newfoundland as a comparison, full of tales of cod tongues, salt pork for Sunday dinner, and seal flipper pie. Now here was another island on the ragged northern edge of the world, full of friendly people, tidy settlements, and interesting cuisine. Iceland is conveniently located between the December gloom of London, where I had just been, and the December gloom of Vancouver, where I needed to be. On the plane from Heathrow, I'd perched on the edge of my seat, excited to expand my horizons, meet new people and see new things. And, of course, excited to eat. My optimism had dwindled once I'd landed. Twilight gave way to driving snow, and the bus from the airport began to fishtail in the darkness. Out in the night, impossibly neat cottages were barely visible. None of this seemed to concern the jolly older man sitting beside me. He was happy to engage me in a one-sided conversation about the joys and struggles of being an Aurora scientist in northern Scotland. He talked the way older men talk, alive with the joy of having an interested audience. At home, he had plenty of the darkness needed for his craft, but it was far too overcast. Instead, he spent time in Siberia and Iceland, supplementing his scientific work by giving Aurora tours to wealthy tourists. I looked out the window, skeptical of his chances for success. I couldn't even tell where the sky ended and the forest began. The wind began violently rocking the bus. I could see the driver tense his arms. His knuckles were white under the occasional streetlight. The Aurora scientist frowned at the snow. He shrugged.
"Don't worry. It will clear. Behind this storm, it will be clear and still."
"Don't you get cold watching the aurora all night?"
"Oh, it's a dry cold. You hardly notice it."
"I'm here to study food."
"Oh, that's grand. Such fish and dairy. Be wary of the shark, though."
He shuddered a little and turned to the window, lost in contemplation of the darkness. The bus slid merrily across the road, the driver cursing in a melodic tongue. I burrowed into my coat and hoped that the hotel would have room service, and maybe a sauna. Iceland is awash in interesting food. I talked to restaurateurs in the snow and dark. I visited thermal greenhouses in the snow and dark. I chatted with ice-eyed fishermen in the snow and dark, next to an ocean of such a forbidding temperament, I couldn't turn my back on it. I loved it. The noonday sun barely graced the horizon long enough to cast a glow on the mountains across the ice-choked harbor. I enjoyed tasting everything I could get my hands on, prowling the streets like a hungry wraith of midwinter. I ate fish as fresh and delicate as snowflakes. I did end up nibbling the fermented shark meat I'd been warned about and regretted it for several hours, as the smell and taste hung on me like a pungent ghost. I munched on lichen. I tossed back salads grown with the heat of volcanoes and ate bread cooked in the ground. I ate a great quantity of skyr, the yogurt that is really a cheese made from the milk of the Icelandic cattle descended from cows brought from Norway in the 10th century. They are now a distinct product of their harsh home, small in stature and few in number, with only 30,000 lactating cows working to fill the breakfast bowls of Iceland. They are unusual cows, their coats pied or brindled in 6 colors, as plush as cats. They are tended on 700 farms that tuck into fertile valleys along the coast, where they eat the local vegetation in small plots of pasture, isolated for millennia from the rest of cattle kind. The Icelandic cow is different, and its milk, extremely high in protein and low in fat, passes that difference along to the sort of butter one can eat by the spoonful. As my Aurora watcher noted, the dairy was sublime. This place and its people have existed for centuries by the graces of fish, cows, and sheep. The world has found Iceland. Tourists flood the streets of Reykjavik. Skyr, so rich and wonderful, is an increasingly prized export in a food-obsessed world, so prized, in fact, that the cows of Iceland cannot possibly keep up with demand. A possible solution would be to crossbreed Icelandic and Norwegian cows to increase production per acre, but in the process, the purebred Icelandic cow would likely go extinct from introduced disease and genetic mixing. There is no real way to make the magical cloud of butter brooding on a slab of volcanic rock available to a wider audience without making it into a pale copy of itself. That butter emerged from centuries of harsh landscape and slow cattle breeding combined with skilled preparation. To lose the butter of Iceland and the foods like it would be a great loss. Many of the unique foods that help to make the world a diverse and interesting place are in danger. The forces of globalization, industrialization, and ecological collapse threaten the wealth of culinary products that make our cultures distinct. Some of these foods are becoming rare, some are becoming much more expensive, and some face outright extinction. Some have already become extinct. To understand these threats, imagine a feast. It can be any feast, a Las Vegas buffet, a family holiday dinner, a South Pacific pit barbecue, or an Indonesian rice tofu, the classic meal of many small dishes served for special occasions. Imagine a meal with many dishes and more food than can possibly be eaten at once. There are 2 things in that feast, aside from a great deal of hidden labor. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of species of plants and animals, a sort of culinary menagerie. There is also a huge body of culinary knowledge, the accumulated knowledge of growing, harvesting, processing, and preparing foods handed down and improved upon over generations. A feast is a bit like a book, but a tasty book we read through eating. Now imagine that the dishes start to disappear one by one. The raspberries for the waffles, the sage on the Thanksgiving turkey, the poi or the pisang goreng. Gone. Slowly, the table becomes less interesting, less captivating, and as each species disappears, the accompanying cultural knowledge vanishes with it. This is the paradox of the lost feast. Even as we enjoy a time in which food is cheaper, more diverse, and more available than ever before, the specter of extinction threatens to radically challenge how we eat. In fact, it is already happening. I took another slice of bread slathered with that fabulous, perhaps endangered, butter. Outside, the snow had stopped, and the sky was deepening into a crisp cobalt glow. The restaurant was called Lava, an aptly named set of rooms nestled beside Iceland's Blue Lagoon hot pools. I was taking some quiet time away from the rush of restaurants, fishing piers, and new flavors. I needed a break from the hours of trudging through deep snow, bent into the wind, my skin cracked and my eyelashes frozen. Floating aimlessly in a pool of hot water with a fine restaurant close at hand seemed an excellent alternative for a day. The water is the byproduct of a nearby thermoelectric plant, and the locals have cleverly converted it into a world-class spa. There is even a bar right inside the pool, and the Icelanders give out wristbands that track alcohol consumption so that one doesn't overindulge and drown. Lava, where head chef Yngvi Fridriksson leads a team dedicated to highlighting Icelandic cuisine, is one of the few fine restaurants in the world where one can wear a bathrobe to the table. And, of course, they have that wondrous bread and butter. Butter is an old innovation. When one milks a cow, the cream separates to the top as a liquid filled with microscopic globules of butter fat that are protected by a membrane. When we agitate cream, we introduce air to the mix, forming a colloid better known as whipped cream. But as any overenthusiastic cook knows, beating the cream further forms something new, butter. Unbeknownst to most, they have ruptured the membrane that has kept the fat in suspension, releasing it into its new form. Humans figured this out as early as 6500 BCE, leaving a buttery residue as evidence on ancient pottery. By 2500 BCE, the Sumerians were crafting tablets illustrating the preparation of butter from cow's milk, a durable if heavy instruction manual. Butter spoils quickly in hot climates, forcing the development of other innovations. They were adding salt to their butter to extend its shelf life by Roman times, and in India, they discovered that one can remove the solids to create a much more lasting substance, known as ghee. In Northern Europe and the United Kingdom, butter was packed into firkins and stored in bogs, where it became rancid but remained edible for a very long time. Occasionally, we still dig up the odd forgotten barrel. The making of butter is such an important culinary innovation because it takes a product with a very short shelf life, milk, and turns it into a product that lasts longer and is easier to transport. And of course, we like butter. We like the taste and we like its texture. It's both rich and satisfying. And in the world of cuisine, satisfying matters. We need food to stay alive. We embrace cuisine out of enjoyment. I was wandering Iceland's midwinter darkness because I'm a professor of culinary geography, a job that combines my love of travel with my love of eating. It isn't all hot pools and butter, though. There are long days of solo travel in difficult conditions, red-eye flights, upset stomachs, and lonely nights spent typing up notes in strange hotels. But these inconveniences are outweighed by the time I get to spend with people who are truly passionate about food and cuisine. I talk to farmers as they rave about new crop varieties, and I get to sit down with chefs after their shifts to swap culinary memories and discuss food adventures. I cross paths with writers poking into every single aspect of the food system, and all of these people feed me, and I feed them. Lately, people who love food have been sharing a growing sense of concern. Farmers, shaken by floods and droughts, talk to me about the changing climate and the challenge posed by increasingly unpredictable weather. Fishers talk of declining stocks and unpredictable prices shaped by international markets. Wild foragers tell me of shrinking habitats and vanishing ecosystems. I'm still enjoying the incredible culinary bounty as people open their kitchens to me, but there is a sense of urgency. The sense that the hour is growing late. Our diverse food systems are increasingly under threat. Cuisine is a language. Languages have two central properties, and the language of food is no different. Primarily, a language allows us to communicate, permitting us to pass on what we have learned to future generations and to other groups of humans, no matter how remote. Through language, we can trade important messages about food. where to find it, how to prepare it, and where in the forest we might want to be on guard for hungry leopards while we forage. However, each language is also a unique way of looking at the world, a point of view influenced by place and time. Each language contains concepts that do not translate easily, and if a language is lost, those ways of seeing the world are lost, too. The French idea of terroir is a good example of this. The term translates very roughly as the taste of the landscape, and suggests the character of a food is intrinsically local. Terroir is shaped by climate, soil, growing techniques, and processing traditions, creating foods linked to a specific land and people. Cuisines have terroir, bringing together ecology and culture to tell a story of what it is to be human. In Canada, for example, we occasionally cook with snow, using the sap of the sugar maples found only in eastern North America. Prairie muffin recipes and terre d'érable, maple taffy, are the best examples, but are certainly not the only way Canadians use snow in cooking. Oaxaca, Mexico is famous for its seven moles, Singapore for its chicken rice. The Scottish have their magical whiskies imbued with brooding peatlands, smelling of wind, long train rides, cozy pubs, and winter nights spent reading Gothic novels. Some foods are so local that they tell the story of a single valley, river, or mountain range. Our understanding of cuisine has progressed in fits and starts across many cultures at different times, though the modern use of the term is quite new. The word comes to us from the Latin coquina, from coquire, to cook. In the Western world, the idea of cuisine didn't enter popular use until late 18th century France, when it was coined by Jean Antelme Brillat-Savarin, a lawyer who narrowly survived the intrigues of the French Revolution. He initially caught the attention of the Revolutionary Committee with a spirited defense of capital punishment. But when the revolution turned into the Reign of Terror, he found himself on the wrong side, with a price on his head, and he had to flee France. Less enthused with capital punishment when it was so very personal a matter, he found himself at loose ends in New York, where he ate, drank, and brooded. He learned to play the violin, eventually performing professionally. In the New World, he pined for the food of his homeland. Under the next regime, he was able to return to France, where he eventually became a magistrate. He pulled back from politics with Napoleon's rise. Tired of the cut and thrust of the political arena, and motivated by a love of the emerging restaurant scene in Paris, he wrote the first serious Western study of food. His masterwork, The Physiology of Taste, was published in 1825, a few years before his death. From him, we get the roots of the modern understanding of cuisine, from its triumphs to its extremes. If you find yourself watching a rerun of the Battle Fruitcake episode of Iron Chef, you can probably blame Brillat-Savarin. His most famous quote is unfortunately the mistranslation, "You are what you eat." What he really said was, "Dis-moi que tu manges, je te dirai que tu es," which translates into, "Tell me what you eat, I will tell you who you are." A much deeper statement on how important cuisine is to identity. To Brillat-Savarin, cuisine was more than the sum of its parts. If we lose our cuisine, we lose a part of ourselves. And oh, such parts. The words of the culinary language are ingredients, and the overwhelming bulk of our ingredients break down into species, though multiple ingredients can come from a single biological source. The complexity of each specific dish has developed over time. Our most fleeting and ethereal meal draws on the experience of centuries. There is, however, still a lot to learn. We are clever at exploiting our environment, yet the potential riches of the world's biosphere are vastly greater than what we currently consume. Plants provide the bulk of our calories, and of the roughly 400,000 plant species on Earth, some 300,000 are potentially edible. Yet we have domesticated and farmed only a few hundred of these plants, and the vast bulk of our calories come from just three: corn, rice, and wheat. This might seem like a shocking lack of imagination, but domesticating a plant takes a lot of work and time. The wild ancestors of many of our most popular food species would be almost unrecognizable to us. Along with our domesticated species, we eat a few thousand wild foods that are harvested regionally, but the vast bulk of edible species are still largely unknown. Our animal protein choices are equally limited. We have a wide variety of foods available from the 65,000 species or so in the coordinates, fish, mammals, amphibians, reptiles, and birds. Yet only 50 or so are domesticated and farmed regularly, and the bulk of animal protein comes from chickens, cows, pigs, and ducks. But we can eat almost all of the coordinates, with a few shockingly poisonous exceptions. Consider Phyllobates terribilis, the golden poison frog. It's descriptively named. If you see one, don't pick it up. In addition, about one quarter of the 70,000 known mushrooms are edible, though many more are either too woody or contain nasty surprises. In the orchard by my house, little patches of destroying angel mushrooms crop up. These look appealing but cause vomiting, cramps, delirium, convulsions, diarrhea, and death. Not an ideal lunch. The possibility of poisoning combined with their rather poor food value might explain why the fungi are unexploited. The same can be said of the invertebrates. We love lobster and toss back a smattering of species, such as snails and sea urchins, but we don't even know how many invertebrates there are on Earth. We certainly haven't tasted them all. The idea of culinary extinction had been haunting me for some time. I spent my days thinking about the rich complexity that food brings to our lives and the loss of species used by humans in their food systems that chips away at that richness, a plant here, an animal there, and with them, piece by piece, goes cuisine. Cuisine is important, and if cuisine is important, culinary ingredients are also important, as are the ecosystems they come from. On my return from Iceland, still thinking of those Icelandic cows, I decided I needed to know more about the set of threats looming over the plants and animals that support our food system. There are already lost foods, and each one has a story to tell. My idea to study culinary extinctions was just that, an idea. Musings at 30,000 feet. For the idea to become an obsession and then a story, I needed to share it with someone also prone to obsessions. I knew just who to talk to. Plan at the ready, I cruised high above Greenland, enjoying my in-flight treat of Yule Sild. Christmas herring. No, really, it's a thing, and it's on Icelandair's Yule menu. As I dozed against the bulkhead, I was blissfully unaware that in less than 24 hours, I would be attacked by birds. I was mugged by a colony of gulls. It was a warm morning, and I was shaking off a restless, jet-lagged night, jotting lazily in my notebook at Granville Island Public Market. I was already exploring how I could expand on my airplane eureka moment. Mapping out a story of the extinction of culinary species in my head was one thing, but getting it onto paper was another matter entirely. 3 coffees into my day, I decided it was time for lunch in the market's oceanfront courtyard. I bought a plate of pad thai, popped on my headphones, and walked through the door, my focus already distracted by the bridges and towers of the city, the shimmering ocean. The market courtyard is an urban back porch, a hidden oasis. Surely it could give me some inspiration. The gulls were waiting above the door. I thought I had the courtyard to myself as I juggled my plate of pad thai, my laptop, my iPhone, and my coffee. And I mentally dismissed the sign on the door warning of aggressive birds. After all, the warning was for tourists. I was a local, an old hand when it came to Granville Island and everything it offers. I was cocky. A half dozen large and aggressive male glaucous-winged gulls dropped onto my head in a fury of pecking beaks and beating wings. They also managed to deliver some well-placed kicks to my eyes with their rubbery little feet. In seconds, my food was on the ground, my coffee was on my shirt, and I was huddling under my laptop, wondering how anything so unpleasant could be accompanied by so much comical squeaking. On the water, a young woman on a paddleboard glided by. Her look of horror suggested that in me she saw some terrible warning,
some indication that if she wasn't careful about her life choices, she could end up surrounded by a cloud of screaming, sauce-stained gulls. Stunned, I watched the birds pull apart my lunch and flap away in a satisfied flurry of feathers and screeching. I touched my head and was surprised to find my fingers came away bloody. I knew someone who would want to see this, and it was the same person I wanted to lure into my culinary extinction experiments. It was fate.
You don't need stitches. Still impressive.
My old friend was trying very hard to suppress a smile. Some small part of him was on the side of the gulls, and I accepted that. He dabbed disinfectant from his field kit onto my scalp.
This is interesting behavior, you know. Quite striking aggression for gulls.
They mobbed me. They took my pad tie. I wanted my pad tie. He made a noncommittal grunt.
They are becoming increasingly well-adapted to city life. I need to set up cameras down there, see if I can capture enough aggressive attacks to work into a conference presentation. Hey, can I take a picture of your head?
For the sake of anonymity, I will call him Geography Dan. He studies, and is obsessed with, the animals that don't need protection from humans. Raccoons, rats, demonic gulls. He follows the lives of the animals who live with us, the sort of animals most humans are rather unhappy to encounter. He loves creatures that even a vegan would surreptitiously crush under their non-leather boot. Dan is also an old college friend, and a wealth of information on every grifter in the animal world. For there are animals we admire in the wild, animals we keep as pets, and animals we use for food. And then there are the other kind. Dan lives in their world. Once students together in Toronto, Dan and I now both work and teach on the West Coast. We commiserate about research grants and fieldwork, and he offers a sympathetic ear for my ramblings about food. He does, however, occasionally try to serve me insects. I mentally reminded myself to search my lunch for anything with too many legs. Dan made us a quick meal of reheated borscht with a generous dollop of sour cream and a chiffonade of green onion and leek, served up with a nice crusty sourdough. The soup was rich with cabbage and paprika and freshly chopped dill. Dan's borscht is a medley of Brassica oleracea and Beta vulgaris, spiced richly with anethum graviolens and capsicum annuum, and a handful of other ingredients, a random collection of species brought together over the years by Dan's sprawling family. Dan and I had first met over food, arguing about the merits of cilantro. I hated it, while he felt anyone could train themselves to like it. The jury remains out, but a decade later I still think it tastes like soap, thanks to a variant of the olfactory receptor gene, OR6A2, found in 10% of the population. As Dan poured some wine, I began naming the components of the soup.
"What's on your mind?" Dan asked. "You seem even more food-obsessed than usual."
"I've been thinking about species as components of cuisine, and how species extinction has a direct impact on cuisine. Culinary extinction, if you will."
"I know you think I never worry about extinction, but those gulls are actually declining in number all around the Pacific Rim. We don't know why. But food species. It seems to me that we have a pretty compelling reason to keep culinary species alive and well. Surely few of the foods we eat have gone extinct as we value them too highly."
I paused, breathing in the warmth of the soup. "It's not that simple, and culinary extinction isn't all that rare. I've been thinking that if we look at historical culinary extinctions, they could show us how our own food systems are in danger."
"Still, if we ate seagulls, I think we'd be more careful about their numbers."
"What? Wait, that doesn't... Dan, there isn't any seagull in this soup, right?"
"No, not as such. Not yet. I mean, no."
"You aren't allowed to serve me seagull." He paused.
"No promises."
From that strange avian attack and our conversation, my idea finally crystallized into a plan of action. I didn't think of gulls as a species that could be threatened, as they were all around me, flapping and screeching, stealing my Thai food. Dan didn't think of food species as threatened because we needed and valued them. Few people make the direct link between the natural world and food species, as we keep them in separate boxes in our minds. We all do it, I might scold Dan for not considering food species as vulnerable, but it's true that I still have a hard time imagining his demon gulls and rats and roaches as vulnerable to threats such as habitat loss and climate change. I wanted to understand.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?